I'm Bob Garfield, and this is episode 2 of our summer podcast series, Bob's Docs. Last week, we examined the notion of manipulation. This week, we'll replay two interviews I did with documentarians who could not have made their respective movies without extraordinary access. The first of the two is a 2003 doc called Terror in Moscow by filmmaker Dan Reed. In October 2002, Chechen terrorists stormed a Moscow theater, firing shots in the lobby that the oblivious audience knew nothing about.
That night's performance was recorded, as was usual, by the theater's video camera.
Then a masked machine gun-toting man appears, fires a shot into the air, and shoves the bewildered actors off the stage. The theatergoers are surrounded by terrorists clad in black from head to toe.
The suicide squad numbered 22 men and 19 women. The women's job was to guard the hostages and, on command, to detonate the explosives strapped to their bodies.
The siege ended with the death of all the terrorists and 129 hostages, most by anesthetic gas pumped into the theater by the Russian security services. Reed, using video actually left behind by the terrorists themselves, presented an extraordinary view of the crisis, the unbearable agony, as 800 people sat for 57 hours waiting to die. When I spoke to him in 2003, he told me that he was astonished to have been given access to that footage and that it was unclear to him why the video was made in the first place.
That's one of the puzzles. Was it to a message to their sponsors? Was it to prove to the people who'd financed the operation that they'd actually done this? Was it to have something to brag about later on if they escaped? Or was it to release to the media? We just don't know. But at any rate, one of the gunmen simply waved the camera around. He filmed the most extraordinary scenes that I've ever seen inside a terrorist operation, basically. It's shot like a home video. He's saying hi to the guys, hi to the girls. People are talking very, very intimately to the camera, saying things, making jokes. It's quite surreal.
Were there any journalistic reservations in using that? Somehow, ex post facto, carrying out the wishes of the terrorists?
We didn't really have any reservations because the story of the siege was told really from the hostages' point of view. The people giving testimony are the people who lost loved ones who were sitting next to them, who never woke up after the gas was introduced. And I think that kind of counterbalances the sort of gunman vision that you get from the tape.
Coincidentally, last night I happened to see the new Quentin Tarantino film, Kill Bill Volume 1. And in it, about 75 people get killed with samurai swords. There's blood spurting out of people's bodies like water from a fire hydrant. It's so graphic that at some point, the images, they just stop being disturbing.
Mm.
Now, the reason I bring this up is I've just 10 minutes ago finished watching your film. And right up to the moment I walked into this studio, I was having difficulty remaining composed. The violence is simply overwhelming. But it's mainly the violence of desperation. It's beyond desperation. It's just this endless waiting for death. It's very difficult to take.
Yeah, yeah. To make a film about people waiting to die and what's more, sitting next to their loved ones and waiting to die with their loved ones was an overwhelming emotional experience for me. And to me, this film really is about being a hostage and what people are like when they face death and they know that death is coming.
Well, I want to ask you about that because the film is just gigantically affecting. It is a monumental achievement. So I hope you won't take me as being argumentative when I ask you why. What do we gain by the exercise of sitting through and vicariously living this terror?
I think we gain two things. I mean, on the one hand, we gain an understanding of what actually happened, and that's worth something in journalistic and historical terms. On a deeper level, I think it's kind of reassuring to know that when faced with the bleakest possible situation in your life, that understanding is possible, that at the end of the day, the hostages ended up not really hating their captors. One man who was the oboist in the orchestra said to me, you know, by the end, I didn't hate the women anymore. To me, they were like the rain. They were like a storm. They were like a natural phenomenon. It was a disaster, but he'd kind of risen above recriminations and hatred.
The film is almost pointedly apolitical. It doesn't really take sides. It is, however, sympathetic, it seems to me, to one particular set of people, and that is the 19 women they called the Black Widows. Tell me about the Black Widows.
These were young women, most of whom had lost a relative or several relatives in fighting with the Russians, men taken away in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. These women all dressed in black with 5 or 6 pounds of explosives strapped around their waist. They were holding in one hand a detonator connected to wires, which would set off the bomb. And in the other hand, they usually wielded a pistol or a hand grenade. So they were very frightening figures, and they sat amongst the audience. And as a result, a lot of people had conversations with the Black Widows. And to me, that was something I was very, very curious about. It was an extraordinary length of time for people to get to know their executioners. It wasn't a case of the hostages identifying with their captors. It was simply a case that over the hours and hours of the siege, they understood that these women had basically been hoodwinked or hoodwinked themselves or were just so desperate that they seemed to have no other course of action. And naturally, they felt a degree of understanding for them.
And yielding this chilling moment at the end of the film where one of the Russian hostages considers the question for a moment and decides that had her son died, would she have done the same thing to exact revenge against the Chechens? And the answer she came up with was, yeah, she would.
Mm. She was a remarkable woman. She'd been shot in the course of the siege. She'd been taken away. Her daughter and husband stayed in the building, and they died of the gas. She had a son who she left at home, who didn't go to the theater. And she says, you know, I hate the Chechens now. I hate them. But had my son not survived, I probably would feel like strapping on a bomb and going and blowing myself up. You know, she's living for her son. And she gives us this insight into the mind of someone who's lost absolutely everyone and everything. I felt it was important to end the film on a complex note. It wasn't a case of, oh, well, everyone lived happily ever after, and here are the good guys and here are the bad guys. You know, there is a bigger issue, which is the war between Chechnya and Russia. And then there's also just a human factor, which is that, you know, I tried to, I suppose, for a second, make people think about what drove these women, the Black Widows, to come there and to show that, you know, they were human too. And if a Russian woman can think that way, well, so can a Chechen woman.
Well, Dan Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Dan Reed is a filmmaker. I spoke to him in 2003. Reed couldn't have made Terror in Moscow without access to that video made by the terrorists. Matthew Heineman's filmmaking depends on a different kind of access, that of hard-won relationships with his subjects. For his 2015 film, Cartel Land, Heineman insinuated himself into vigilante groups on both sides of the Mexican border, fighting against official impotence or worse to protect their communities from the drug trade. In the film, Heineman captures extraordinary moments of violence, corruption, cult of personality, and even adultery, all recorded with the subject's full participation. We'll have to take care about spoilers, but to me, the greatest thing about your film is the juxtaposition of the opening sequence where we see two cartel workers preparing to cook a whole mess of meth with the closing, which features a kind of pullback to reveal, and that shocking reveal tells us everything about the polluted ecosystem that is the Mexican drug trade. And to get this footage, you had to be in the middle of the Mexican desert, in the middle of the night, with narcos. Holy hell.
That is a scene that I fought so hard to get. Michoacan, where I was filming, is an incredibly resource-rich area. You know, if you go out tonight and you go have a taco, the avocado is most likely coming from Michoacan. If you go have a mojito, the lime is most likely coming from Michoacan. If you go do meth tonight, the meth is most likely coming from Michio Kan. So meth was a really, really important part of this story. And every single shoot, I'd go down there and, you know, ask somebody, do you know somebody, do you know somebody who's quote unquote connected? And week after week, month after month, we failed. And then it was on what I thought was our last shoot. We got a call saying, be in this town square at 6 p.m. and you're in. We went to this town square and a group of masked men met us. And before this, we had set up ground rules. My rule was that I didn't want my face to be bagged or to be thrown in the back of a trunk. And their rule was that they wanted their faces to be covered. And so these masked men drove us through these towns and smaller towns and then fields and then smaller fields. And we get out into this forest and, you know, here's this mobile meth lab. The sun is dipping beneath the mountain and it's basically pitch black. And I don't shoot with lights. And so I couldn't see a darn thing with my camera. And I couldn't believe I'd fought for so long to get into this position and suddenly couldn't see anything. And then the head chef starts showing me around the lab with this little flashlight. It's with this little flashlight that I lit the scene.
You're very much prepared for this situation based on all your years covering war and violence and terrorism. So this is like right up your alley. What was your last film about?
Healthcare, which is a different type of battle, shall we say. Yeah, I was not prepared at all for any of this stuff. You know, this film led me into shootouts, into torture chambers, and, you know, here into this meth lab that we're discussing. And, you know, I'd never been in any situation like this before.
Which makes one wonder how you got from healthcare policy to the middle of the desert.
Well, I'd read this Rolling Stone article about these vigilantes on the U.S. side of the border. It was a world that just fascinated me. I knew nothing about it. I was really intrigued by sort of what provokes men and women to, you know, quote unquote, take the law into their own hands. And so I reached out to this journalist, Damon Tabor. He introduced me to Tim Naylor Foley, who led this group called Arizona Border Recon. And I spent about 7 months gaining his trust.
Okay, you began with Tim Foley, who was an American veteran and heads this group that is equal parts right-wing militia and Neighborhood Watch. Here's Foley from the beginning of your film.
Technically, we're vigilantes upholding the law where there is no law. But the phrase vigilante, it's been given a bad name by the media.
They are heavily armed and claim to be protecting our state from foreign threats and from our own government. But the state's growing militia movement is causing concern among law enforcement.
Fire.
Back in the day, vigilante wasn't a bad thing. Say the bandits was riding into your town, the townspeople would all get together and, you know, defend their town.
He was extraordinarily reticent about taking part at first. You know, he had deep distrust of the media, of the quote-unquote, you know, New York liberal media, of which I was apparently a part of. And so we'd talk on the phone once a week, once every couple of weeks. And I told him, I'm not going to bring my own personal beliefs into this experience. You know, I really want to allow you to be yourself and to let the story unfold as it would unfold naturally. So many documentary films put people in nice, neat little boxes. And, you know, my goal was to not do that.
You said you didn't want to arbitrarily put people in a box. Sometimes they constructed the box for themselves. There is this little rant from one of Tim Foley's militia members, which is kind of self-indicting.
The reason I come down here is to do something about having a porous border. The truth is, tall fences make for better neighbors. Especially if you have conflicting ideas. You wouldn't put two pit bulls in the same pen and expect them to get along and not fight. Why would you put two races in the same nation and expect them to get along?
When you heard this explicitly racist explanation for this guy's motivation, what kind of box did that put you in as a filmmaker if you don't want to stereotype?
You know, I didn't want to stereotype, but I also wanted to, you know, be honest and truthful as to why they're down there. To not show this would not be telling, you know, an honest and truthful portrait of what's happening down there.
Now, you do spend quite a bit of time with Arizona Border Recon in the film, but clearly the larger part of your documentary concerns a kind of mirror image group, albeit much larger, on the other side of the border called Auto Defensas. Tell me who they are and how you got onto them.
So I'd been filming in Arizona for about 4 or 5 months, and then my father sent me this article about the Autodefensas, a group of citizens in the Mexican state of Michoacán, west of Mexico City, you know, deep down in Mexico, who were rising up to fight back against the Knights Templar cartel, a vicious, vicious cartel. And almost immediately, I wanted to make this parallel story of vigilantism on both sides of the border. I reached out to a journalist that had written a profile piece on the leader of this group, El Doctor José Manuel Morales. And I asked her, you know, what's he like as a character? And she said he's the single most interesting man I've ever been around.
Tall, handsome, charitable, brave.
And these deep, dark eyes, as she described them. Even if a quarter of what she said was true, those are music to any documentary filmmaker's ears. 2 weeks later, we were in Mexico filming. And I thought I was going to be down there for 1 or 2 weeks. And 1 or 2 weeks turned into 9 months. I was down there for about 1 or 2 weeks of every month for 9 months.
And what a 9 months. You filmed Autodefensas beating up cartel members. You filmed one of the bosses giving an order to kill one of the cartel members. You filmed shootouts. You documented the mutation of Autodefensas into a criminal gang in its own right. Late in the film, you record the sainted El Doctor Mireles hitting on, actually more than just hitting on, a young girl 40 years his junior and not his wife. I repeat, Matthew, holy hell. Tell me again why you aren't in a shallow grave somewhere.
That's something I don't necessarily like to think about too much, I guess. There's obviously an element of good fortune and luck. The truth be told, though, you know, I definitely had an element of protection by being, you know, a white American, by having a blue passport. Since 2000, 90 journalists have been killed covering the drug wars in Mexico. You know, that being said, you know, when you're out in the middle of the desert, if you're in the middle of a shootout, you know, the bullets don't really care what zip code you're from. So I feel very fortunate. And I owe an enormous amount to my amazing and tiny crew, especially my local fixer, Daniel Fernandez.
There are a couple of scenes that, if you're a documentarian, and you understand what is being said, you're probably shaking because you realize how important the film is that you're recording. And after El Doctor Mireles is injured in an apparent murder attempt, his fill-in to lead Autodefensas while he's out is a character known as Papa Smurf. And at one critical point, Papa Smurf is addressing the citizens of a town that Autodefensas hopes to liberate from the cartel as it has liberated other towns in the region.
That scene, actually, you know, I'd filmed about 20 Papa Smurf speeches. So I was like, I can't film another one of these. And for whatever reason, the light was twinkling in a certain way. I decided, you know, I'm going to film one more. And it turned out to be this amazing scene in which this town, you know, challenges him. This man in the crowd challenges him and asks him, who gives you the authority to do what you do? You know, you're robbing our houses. You come in with your guns. You're flirting with our women. You know, who gives you the authority to do this? We joked in the edit room. You know, we called this guy Charlie Rose because he asked all the questions that, you know, that we as audience members wanted to know.
And this is the turning point because he's identified what we've begun to suspect but really aren't quite sure of as an audience, which is that Autodefensas, especially without El Doctor Mireles, has lost its moral center and really mutated into the very sort of criminal organization that it's supposed to defend people against. Did you know at that point where this film was headed?
At that point, I had an inkling of what was happening for sure. You know, at first, it really seemed like it was a story of good versus evil, of everyday citizens fighting back against the evil cartel. And things changed pretty quickly, and these lines between good and evil became ever more blurry until, you know, by the end of the film, they were almost indistinguishable. You know, I could be on a mission, on an operativo. I could be in the back of a truck and look to my left or look to my right and not know if I was with the cartel or the people fighting the cartel, or something in between, you know, as we see in the end of the film. you know, it's a really, really complicated maze to navigate as all these allegiances were shifting, as people were literally and figuratively changing shirts. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to do in editing this film, was to allow you as an audience member to go on that same journey that I went on. All those moments where I thought I understood what was happening, but things changed, either about my character or about the movement itself, I wanted you to feel those same moments. All those moments where I felt like the rug was pulled out from under me, I wanted you to feel those same moments as well.
Among the other things that are profound about this film is that at one point it becomes kind of a cinematic Milgram experiment, where before we really understand how far autodefenses has gone to the side of evil, we hear them interrogating cartel members or suspected cartel members, and we hear in the background the sounds of people being tortured. And at this stage, I am not saying to myself, oh my God, these people are evil. They're torturing these guys. As an audience, I'm going, wait, oh my God, they're torturing. But, well, these are brutal killers. It's not plain to me that some moral corner has been turned. It's not long. But even then, I'm still personally kind of delivering the shock, or at least standing by with my arms folded while the shock's being delivered. How about you?
You know, that's one of the things that constantly plagued me and would keep me up at night. You know, what would I do? What would I do if my brother was hanging from a bridge or my sister was raped? You know, would I grab a gun? Is it okay to fight violence with violence? You know, is vigilantism sustainable? These are all questions that drew me into this world and constantly pushed me both intellectually, emotionally, and physically to make this film. You know, I would sneak into this room, this large bathroom that they used to interrogate people. You know, I would record sound. I would pretend like I was going in the bathroom. I would go into a stall and record sound. I would walk into this room and pretend, you know, like I was having conversations, and I would record, because to not capture this, to me, would be wrong. You know, this was part of the fabric of what made this movement what it was. I felt, you know, a huge duty and obligation to show it.
One thing I can reveal about the scene that reveals so much is that two of these meth cooks have a fatalistic view of the drug trade and all of the collateral damage. They say this.
Of course, cartels, mafia, whatever you want to call it, are involved in this. They're involved in everything. I mean, some way, somehow, everybody has gone corrupted. The auto defenses and the people cooking meth, we're pretty much the same team. We're actually helping fund the auto defenses. Us selling drugs or cooking drugs, it just doesn't look right. But it will always happen. You can't stop the cartel, no matter what you do. It's either Michoacan cooks it, Sinaloa cooks it, Guerrero cooks it. It's just never going to stop, period.
Is he right? Is it ever going to stop?
I think, you know, the elephant in the room is, you know, America's voracious appetite for drugs. You know, it's basic supply and demand. It's basic economics. As long as there's a demand for drugs here in the States, you know, there'll be a supply of drugs coming from Mexico and South America. And with that, the violence that's resulted since 2007 in 100,000 plus people being killed. And, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I really wanted to highlight with this film, is that, you know, there's a war that's happening in the country just south of us, resulting in so many deaths and so much terror and fear and suffering. You know, and we're connected to this. We're responsible for this to some degree.
Matthew, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Heineman is a filmmaker. His latest documentary, City of Ghosts, follows a group of Syrian citizen journalists defying ISIS and the Assad regime to get news out from their home city of Raqqa. You can find my interview with him about that film at onthemedia.org. Thanks for listening to this latest episode of our summer series, Bob's Docs. Next week, Prurient, in which we admit that we all just love to watch. I'm Bob Garfield.